panel with William Moore presiding.
Be seated, please. All right, good afternoon. We're on the record in the consolidated case 3AN18-09814. I have received proposed findings and a written closing statement from the Disability Law Center and the proposed findings from the state. Are there other materials that were submitted?
Yes, Your Honor, we submitted a brief, and also I did email the proposed findings to Ms. Bozzini.
Did you file it just electronically or also in paper?
No, I thought that we served chambers with the
okay. Brief. I haven't seen that yet, but I will look for it. I'll make sure that I and if for some reason it's not there.
I perhaps I misunderstood, Your Honor. I sent the findings by electronically. I did not send the brief electronically. I may have misunderstood.
But you filed you sent it to Ms. Mozzini,
the electronic
findings?
Okay. Yeah.
And she's probably got them. And did you file a paper argument?
Yes.
Okay. I haven't seen that yet. I'll make sure that I look for it.
I have an extra copy of the court. Wants that.
Sure. I'm not going to be able to read it before now, but I'll take it. Thank you. So, I propose that I hear from DOE, then the Disability Law Center, and then the state. And are they going to be both the two departments arguing?
I'm only arguing on behalf of DHS.
Yeah, Your Honor, I'll see what's brought up and see if there's anything I need to add to Mr. Bookman's argument.
Okay.
Your Honor, as the court's aware, the Public Defender Agency sought in October to seek remedies on behalf of its mentally ill and vulnerable clients who are being detained in corrections while awaiting transport for evaluation. This case has been ongoing since that time, and throughout this period, there have been repeated instances where our clients have been held in corrections, sometimes for days at a time. Some individuals have been held in corrections on more than one occasion awaiting transfer to the Alaska Psychiatric Facility or another state facility. We have filed a fairly detailed brief, so I'm not going to go into all of the arguments, but I will try to hit the highlights here. First of all, the placement of our clients in correctional facilities is a direct result of the state's policies and procedures. In their pleadings, they admit that in October, API stopped admitting individuals who had been ordered to the facility for evaluation and treatment. They consciously adopted policies and a capacity policy that would result in correctional placements for mentally ill individuals. They admit in their pleadings this is an inevitable consequence of their capacity policy. They say, quote, it is unclear what else could happen other than detention at a DOC facility. So this was deliberate on their part, or a deliberate consequence of what the state was doing. They were not providing appropriate care for those individuals who were under orders for hospitalization and evaluation. In our brief, we talk about the clinical harm, the inhumane treatment that this entails for mentally ill individuals. Even the state's own expert that they hired to assist them in trying to turn around the Alaska Psychiatric Institute stated that jail placements just make people worse and worse. The two primary cases we've cited, and the case that's perhaps most on point, is Lynch v. Baxley. In that case, the 11th Circuit determined that as a matter of substantive due process, individuals who were awaiting civil commitment proceedings could not be placed in correctional settings. I would urge the court to read Lynch carefully. That case, in our view, very well sets out the standards and the protections under the federal constitution. And those protections are in place for our clients. This is a 1984 case. frankly, there isn't a lot of authority past that in some respects addressing this issue of civil commitment and placing people in jail because it just doesn't.
I haven't read Link. Was there a statute in the state or the federal system that permitted housing people in a correctional facility under rare circumstances, or was there not? Do you remember?
Not that I recall, but that there was. I don't believe there
so
was a specific.
Is it your position order. That the statute that allows in specific circumstances housing at corrections, that that's on its face unconstitutional?
I would say to be constitutional, it has to be interpreted in a way that's very limited, Your Honor, and I can address that if you will, because we certainly, apart from the federal constitutional problems, which we think are frankly quite clear, it's our view that the state law does not authorize this. The statute, AS 473705, is the statute addressing emergency protective custody. Typically, when you have an emergency detention, that precedes the order issued under 473700. So the cohort we're actually talking about here for the most part are people who are under orders under 473700. The court has ordered them and authorized their hospitalization for evaluation. So at that point, under the orders, it's the department's obligation to get that individual immediately and promptly to an evaluation and to a treatment facility. Protective custody has to be limited. It can't be indefinite. We can't have people in corrections waiting and waiting and waiting. Certainly, I think we all understand that in Alaska, particularly in outlying communities, there may only be a correctional setting where someone would be safe. And so those individuals are probably going to be held for time-limited periods in corrections before they're flown in. And certainly sometimes there could be weather delays. But in our view, an interpretation of that statute allowing for the types of detentions we're seeing here would just be an unconstitutional interpretation of the statute.
So let's talk about Anchorage. Is there, what would you have me order or the department do in the situation where they have, for a whole host of reasons, limited capacity, and a person who is under an evaluation order who, for however, whatever reason, got to the jail and is sitting in the jail? What order do I issue?
Well, before I get to that, Judge, I think in earlier proceedings you had asked at one point whether there were any other standards. And there is actually a statutory standard for people who are held on involuntary alcohol holds, and that is a 12-hour limitation on being in detention. So that is 4737170. Excuse me?
That cuts both ways. I mean, if the legislature intended a 12-hour for a certain subset of persons and not for this subset, what am I to do with that?
Well, I'm bringing that up to at least advise the court there is that statutory standard. My point would be as to 473705, there has to be a constitutional boundary to that detention. You've asked what you can order.
Go ahead.
In those courts that have considered the question of whether a mentally ill person can be detained in a jail, judges have acted. They have said this cannot be done. And then it is left, frankly, to the government to come up with less restrictive alternatives, to come up with meaningful alternatives. It is unconstitutional to hold mentally ill individuals who are civilly detained in corrections.
As a practical matter, let's assume I agree with you, whether it's initially or after 12 hours or 24 hours or whatever, and the person is nonetheless severely incapacitated, incapable of caring for himself or herself, and you want me to issue an order that simply says release that person from corrections onto the street? Or do I issue another order that says API, or, you know, the department, do something else, you figure it out?
Well, I think to some extent.
And if the department doesn't figure it out, what am I supposed to do with the person while the department is trying to figure it out?
I can appreciate the court's concern about these vulnerable individuals. And frankly, in individual cases, it varies as to what relief we ask for on behalf of our clients. what has typically happened in these types of cases in the federal courts is there is an order from the court. If the state doesn't come up with an alternative that satisfies the court, the state's sanctioned and penalties are issued. This is a public health crisis. It began well before October, but it certainly accelerated and was amplified to a great degree in October. The state still has not addressed this. They have not addressed this population in a meaningful way to come up with alternatives. They had other options. They hired a management team.
There needs to be sort of a general plan, if you will, and a case-by-case specific application of that plan to the individual, given that individual's particular needs. I mean, at one end of the spectrum, I can have a comatose person sitting in a jail cell that I don't know what to do with. But my point here is, as a practical matter, do I at first say to the state, come up with a plan to deal with how you treat the people who are awaiting evaluations, and give me that plan in 15 days or 30 days?
Are you asking about the psychiatric boarding or the individuals in jail?
I'm sorry.
Are you asking about the psychiatric boarding or the individuals in jails?
Well, first, I'm in either case.
Well, I think that the court can make findings as to whether these detentions are lawful or not, and then instruct the state to come up with a prompt plan to address the needs of these individuals.
So you want me to, in the first instance, to say to the state, come up with a plan that leaves at least some flexibility depending on the specifics of the individuals who are actually in the future affected by this plan?
Yes, but I have to say we would prefer that the court, on behalf of our clients, it would be preferable if the court granted the Disability Law Center's injunction and simply prevented the state from placing anyone in a correctional setting. Because it does not seem that the state can mitigate.
That goes back to my earlier question, which I still don't understand your answer about. Are you claiming that it is entirely unconstitutional to put somebody in the DOC facility? Is the statute unconstitutional? I mean, if the answer is yes under all circumstances, that's one thing. If the answer is no, under some circumstances they can be placed there, then I have to figure out what those circumstances are.
I would say in terms of 473705, it's an extremely time-limited detention. And frankly, in the Anchorage area, I'm not sure that it could be constitutional to place people in corrections while awaiting space at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. So I think it depends on, in part, on why they're in protective custody and what the delay is. I'm not asking you to find the entire statute unconstitutional. I would say, though, that it cannot be interpreted so that there's some indeterminate ongoing protective custody when there's no room at the inn. That just cannot be the case. And again, I think our more foundational argument is that placing civil detainees in corrections under the conditions that they are in, based on the undisputed testimony, that is unconstitutional under the federal constitution and would also be unconstitutional.
I see two scenarios that are common. One is the, I think, seven or so individuals that we've identified who do not have criminal charges and were brought into the correctional facility with the evaluation order. That's one category. And then there's a handful of individuals who have been in corrections under criminal charges, which were then dropped. Do you see any distinction between the treatment of those two categories, the ones who are, you know, the first group that are brought in with no criminal charges versus the ones who are there whose charges have been dropped?
No, Judge, I don't. Because the state's power to civilly detain someone comes from two sources, all right? There can be either a parens patriae argument that the individual needs to be detained or restrained of liberty for care, or there can be a police power exercise because the person's dangerous to themselves or others. Those are the powers that allow the state to civilly detain someone. But it's very clear under the federal constitution that you cannot civilly detain people in punitive settings. So once those criminal charges are gone, there's no basis for a detention other than a civil detention.
Okay, so now I have a situation where I have a person who was brought in without criminal charges or the criminal charges dropped. Either, in, regardless of how that got in there, you want me to issue an order to say that person has to be released in 6 hours or 12 hours, regardless.
I'm asking the court to find that it is unconstitutional to hold them in a punitive setting.
That's a charming word, but it doesn't help me deal with what do I do with those people who are being unconstitutionally held. Do I release them immediately? Are you asking me to do that?
I'm asking that the state be directed to come up with less restrictive alternatives for their detention if they're going to be detained while awaiting treatment.
And while the state is doing that, do you want me to release the person, or do I wait until the state comes with the alternate thing?
Well, I think that this needs to be done with urgency. And frankly, again, this is a public health crisis. This has been going on for months and months.
Don't answer my question. I'm asking what you want me to make the state do and what I'm supposed to do with the person while the state is struggling to figure out what to do. I agree with you that at a minimum the state has failed the statutory duty. There's no question in my mind about that. But I'm trying to figure out, other than order the state to do more and to do more immediately, both in terms of getting staffing and figuring out what to do with this population who is awaiting admission, do I release people into the streets?
I'm not asking for that specific remedy, Your Honor. On behalf of our individual clients, we are going before the court. In some cases, we do ask for release. In other cases, we don't. That's a very, in my view, specific inquiry that depends on the facts of the case. It depends on what the client is asking for. It depends on the nature, frankly, and the severity of their disabilities. And in some cases, our obligation to protect them as impaired and incapacitated clients. So no, I think that's beyond the scope of what we can do in this case, in this setting.
You want me to make some pronouncement about violation of statute and some pronouncement about there being a constitutional violation beyond some point, whether temporal or under some circumstances, placing the person in the facility at all?
From our view, I would say apart from the outlying communities, placement in the correctional settings in Anchorage is unconstitutional. Under Lynch, under the controlling Ninth Circuit law, King,
under
Jonah.
All circumstances in Anchorage?
Yes.
So are you asking me to issue an order that says that the department, no state actor can place a person in the correctional facility at all? The correctional facility simply has to refuse them, must refuse them, and the department can't seek to place the person there?
I believe that would be within the scope of what the Disability Law Center is asking for in their injunction,
Your Honor. Are you asking for that?
We would join in that request, Judge, yes.
Okay.
The final point I would make is that, and again, this is briefed in our, it's provided in briefing. The state's lack of resources or lack of facilities or lack of ability to do this is really not a defense to the constitutional violation. So the court can issue an order finding that these practices are unconstitutional. We appreciate that the state would need, and we hope, attempt to remedy that in an extremely prompt manner. If they're not able to do that, then the court can and should enter sanctions against them to force them to do what they need to do, which is care for vulnerably mentally ill people. That's their duty. That's their obligation. The orders that are issued, directed to the department, telling them that they need to provide transport and evaluation and treatment, are directed to the department. And so it's the department's obligation to serve these individuals, to help care for these individuals, and to see that they receive appropriate care and treatment. putting them in jail is not an answer. It's harming them, it's inhumane, and it's making them worse. And so we do request that the court make the findings we've requested.
Thank you.
Your Honor, before I get started, did you have a time limit in mind? Okay, I'll go ahead and start then. I have fairly short statement prepared today because we also submitted written arguments. But before I jump into that, I'll just try to address some of the questions that just came up, specifically about the case Lynch. In that case, that's a case out of Alabama, and there actually was a state statute allowing for civil respondents to be held in jails. And it was actually broader than the statute that we have here in Alaska. It allowed for holding people in jails where no other facility was available. And so what the court did in Lynch was look at all the alternatives that were available to the state. And I think applying that case to the motion that's before the court, the idea of asking for a plan from the state would be in keeping with the relief that we're requesting, because we're not asking for immediate release from jail. We're asking for immediate release from jail if something can't be, if something else can't be done. What we're asking for is for people to be in appropriate facilities. If the state can't come up with a plan where that's possible, then yes, we think people should be released, with the caveat that we do think alternatives are possible. One alternative that comes to mind is similar to what happened in Lynch. The state can hold in the facilities that they currently have for evaluation facilities, they can hold a certain number of beds open that they think are sufficient to take that number of people that would otherwise be diverted to DOC. They can coordinate with police in outside areas and also in Anchorage to make sure that instead of going to DOC, that person is diverted to one of those beds. They can also contract for beds with private hospitals like they've done with North Star. These are just some of the alternatives that I think are in keeping with the alternatives that were that the court brought out in Lynch.
Let's assume that I order the state to come up with a plan. And what happens to people either in DOC in the next 30 days, 40 days, 60 days, whatever? What happens to people who are sitting in the hospital? What are you asking me to do regarding those individuals? And I realize it might be different for each.
Excuse me.
I mean, the state isn't going to have a magical wand that's going to say, we've got 80 beds tomorrow. So until they get those 80 beds, and they may need more, but until then, what do we do with the people? What do you want me to tell the state to do, if anything, about the people awaiting?
Well, you're right. The two populations are a little different. So for the people in jail, I think that having the state have a certain amount of time that the court finds is acceptable to come up with a plan to move those people to more appropriate facilities in, say, 2 weeks or whatever amount of time. That would be a plan that I think we could be supportive of. On the hospital side, we recognize that the state is probably nowhere near getting API back up to capacity. And so what we're trying to do is think of ways to serve respondents while they're waiting in the meantime. So one thing that we're asking for is for the people that are in more appropriate settings, the people that are at least in hospitals, that some sort of evaluation be provided to those people. It's something that the court went through with Dr. Gurris. In evaluation to find out whether people actually meet criteria and need to be there or not. Again, the relief we're asking for is basically saying, we think there's alternatives out there. What can we do? And if the state can come forward and say, it is impossible to provide any evaluation of any kind, again, something we don't agree with, if that's something that they say is impossible, then yes, we don't think it's okay for people to be held indefinitely in ERs.
What do I do with them?
On the hospital side, again, I think the state could come up with a plan for how they are going to provide those evaluations. They could go in to the hospitals and find out who no longer meets criteria, those people could be released, thereby releasing stress on the system. For the people that do meet criteria, there could be an interim period here where the court's order may have to allow for people to remain where they are while the state continues to build up capacity. But I think if the state comes back with the answer that there is no answer and there's nothing we can do and people need to wait indefinitely, the court may be left with no other option but to release people.
Is that an individualized decision? I mean, I can envision it, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head, you can stay in the ER for 3 days until someone from the department sees you. And then you could, maybe you get released from the ER, but if you have to stay longer, you can only stay another, I'm making it up, 4 days, pick a number. And then when you reach that limit, do I automatically send you out, or do I have to have some sort of individualized determination of whether for this particular individual it would be too dangerous, too emotionally damaging to be released on the street, if that's the option?
Your Honor, there may be individuals where there is some kind of increased concern from the court about releasing people. Again, I would, and maybe individual assessments are needed on that point. Again, I would just emphasize that I think it's possible for the state to come up with a plan where in an interim period, yes, people who need treatment, remain where they are. People who don't meet criteria are released. Then after a certain period of time that the court thinks is appropriate, the state has in place a plan so that they've got beds available for those people to be transferred to. Your Honor, I think I'll just move to some of the smaller pieces of relief that we've asked for. We've covered most of what I wanted to cover today. Two other smaller pieces that we've asked for are that defendants provide notice and notice of rights, the order authorizing detention, and attorney info to all respondents. And that's something that the state has said would not be possible unless they're the party that's petitioning. That's just something that we don't agree with. We think that the state has a list of respondents and where they are, and the state may be aware of certain facilities where providing that information is routine. If there are facilities where providing that information is not routine, the state could coordinate with those hospitals facilities and make sure that it becomes routine. It's just not a question as to where people are, so I don't understand why that's not possible. The other minor point is the issue of the roster that we've requested. The state has stated the request for that roster is now moot due to the court's discovery order, I think in January. We just wanted to point out two small...
I had ordered that the state, I think it was every week, update people who were subject to an evaluation order, where they were and how long they were there and where they went. And you want that to be a continuing obligation?
Your Honor, we want that to be a continuing obligation. We also want that information to go to the court because we think that's the only information we have to keep up to date. One thing that we asked for originally in the motion is that information also go to the court, and the discovery order just didn't require that. The other point on that request for relief is that we also ask, along with the roster, for an explanation of how people are prioritized to get into API. And the state has said that that is not relief that should be granted, because there is no prioritization for people in API. They're just chronological. I would just submit to the court that the state's story on how people are prioritized is a bit inconsistent. I believe it's on page 10 of their findings and conclusions where we hear a lot of different reasons why people might not go in immediately, even though they're at the top of the list. And then later on, we hear that there is no prioritization. So I would say that that's still an open question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I don't want to start by saying there's no problem here, but I do want to address some kind of a dichotomy that I'm seeing here. There's the problem of where we are in this case, and there's the problem of what was asked for in this case, and there's the problem, I think, that you've pointed out of the short term and the long term. I think as Deputy Commissioner Wall pointed out and freely stated, there's a large problem. There's a very large problem. No one's saying there's DHSS agrees with that. And we presented a lot of evidence on what DHSS plans to do about that in the long term. Those are long-term questions. And to the extent that there was discussion from the plaintiffs here about how the state can come up with a plan, the state showed you its plan. We talked about what we're talking about.
Well, up to a point. The plan that the state described was attempting to privatize in an effort to increase the number of medical providers and support staff, if you will, and thus to open up API to its physical capacity. Okay. There's at least an evolving plan in that regard. There's no plan whatsoever about what to do with the people who can't get into API while this transition to WellPath proceeds.
That's not a plan that's with regard to API. I think you heard testimony about what services are available at DOC, and I think what the plaintiffs have suggested is that there could be a plan where evaluators sort of go to hospitals or to the jails and see if people really meet standard, right? And so I think the problem with considering that as a route was that what Dr. Gurris told you, and she's the one with experience in doing these things, is that such an evaluation would be substandard, unethical, and it wouldn't work. And
the
you also
that is currently in place is ethical, standard, and appropriate?
That gets back to the second dichotomy, which is mandatory injunction versus preliminary freezing the status quo injunction, right? I am not saying that the system we have now is good or should be continued or anything like that. But when you ask for a mandatory injunction, right, those are extremely disfavored. They are granted only if the facts and law are clear, and they are seldom granted before final hearing.
Okay, so what if I grant a preliminary injunction that says to the state, come up with a plan to deal with the people who are awaiting an evaluation, subject to an evaluation order, but for whom there is not room at API?
I don't think they actually asked for that, Your Honor.
What if you don't have any objection to me imposing that, do you?
I have a question about whether the facts and law are clear that can be done beyond what has been explained to you so far.
But nothing has been explained to me so far about what the plan is for the people who can't get into North Star or API. There is no plan. There's just let them sit there, whether that be in corrections or at the emergency room. And if I'm misstating the facts, what is the plan?
My recollection of the evidence was that we have proceeded forward with contracts with North Star, that we've expanded the capacity at Fairbanks, excuse me, that, as Director Moreau stated, there's a crisis recovery center being opened in Juneau. And no, there is not going to be a plan for next week. There isn't. Beyond the services, they're already available.
I acknowledge the efforts of the state and its contractor to expand capacity in API at North Star and at some other facilities, and that they're exploring that capacity. But when I asked the WellPath people, have there been discussions with the state about what you're going to do with the people who can't get into those facilities? And the answer was no. No discussion, no plans. No plans in the make. I find that to be troubling.
I hear you, Your Honor, but I would say that what WellPath does is run hospitals. And
what the state does is fulfill a statutory obligation.
Yes.
So what is the state doing to do that?
I can't present evidence beyond what we already did, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence that they're doing anything other than trying to increase the staffing at API and to increase North Star and perhaps alternate facilities?
I would point you to the discussion, to the testimony of Jen Moreau and Laura Russell, but otherwise, no.
Okay.
So getting back to the, you know, I mentioned the mandatory versus the preliminary injunction. When you look at Lynch, Lynch was a final order, right? Lynch had 2 years of discovery in which people looked at things. And part of the problem that plaintiffs are talking about when they talk about Lynch is that Alabama's broken up into counties, and the probate judges there were only looking at what was available in their individual county, right? And the appeals court noted that if jail is the only county facility which would protect society, it is the least restrictive facility. But the district court made a mistake in thinking that the probate judges could only look at their county, and the appellate court held, no, you can look beyond your county, right? And so you can look to that. The county has the option to deport, to transport the detainee to a nearby public facility in another county or pay for confinement in a local private facility having quarters for mentally ill patients. And so the question here is, where are there other quarters, right? And this is similar to the Gabriel C. case, right, in which the Alaska Supreme Court said, don't just look at the nearest facility, look at the other facilities. But the testimony that we have in this hearing right now is that Fairbanks operates at capacity, Juneau operates at capacity, and API operates at capacity. And so to say that Lynch says you can never have people in correctional facilities at all, I think goes beyond what Lynch actually said. Lynch said, look to other resources beyond your county, but we don't have a county system. We have a statewide system. What we talked about at the conditions at the Department of Correction were that the conditions were there for safety, which is a legitimate reason, as the King Court noted. And the plaintiffs in both of their pleadings noted that it was a safety plan. Nobody said it wasn't motivated by anything else. Nobody said there was no other way to do it. It wasn't arbitrary. It wasn't capricious. They weren't being housed separately just because there was a court order. So that's not what we should be looking at here. It's disfavored. But again, what we're looking at is not the overall plan of what is wrong with the mental health system, because this isn't a final hearing. This is a preliminary injunction hearing at which certain things were requested, right? I am not asking that the case be dismissed entirely today, right? There, I imagine, will be more discovery and more hearings. But the actual things requested, right, are really specific. Doe said, modify everything at DOC so it looks like API. And their authority for that is King. But King says that it's only a presumption that conditions are punitive if they are similar to jail conditions. And if there are legitimate reasons, then that presumption has been rebutted. And I believe that presumption has been rebutted. Everybody from DOC said that all of the conditions, from the different uniforms to the being apart from the other inmates, that all of them were for the respondent's safety.
But the result, though, is that they're in exactly the same facility as the criminal defendants 3 feet away from them. And most of those individuals, unfortunately, in a well-intentioned effort to keep them apart from people they are on criminal charges, they end up in segregation longer. They're left in the Highland cell or the Mike Mott cell longer than the person with pending criminal charges. It may well be in an effort to keep them safe, but that seems to me to be troubling.
I don't dispute that it's very troubling that they were essentially in their cells for, 23, 22 hours a day. I don't think there was evidence on the comparison between other inmates and Title 47 respondents.
Title 47, the people in DOC facilities are in segregation longer than the guys charged with the crimes. Because you're not in segregation when you're charged with crimes, unless you, misbehave and you've got punitive segregation.
At this hearing, I don't think there was evidence presented about that.
Okay. If there was, do you think that is meaningful? I don't think you can.
I don't think the comparison matters. I think the fact that it happens at all matters, right?
I want to make sure I understand. You're saying that the only reason that these individuals have been put into corrections is for their own safety, and that ends the inquiry.
No, I think maybe I'm misunderstanding. I think it was legitimate to inquire as to why they were being held separately, and the answer is because of safety. So I think that resolves the inquiry, at least for purposes of King and at least for purposes of a mandatory injunction, right? Because the facts and the law have to be clear, right? And it's not, all the evidence is that's the way to do it, right? There isn't evidence that there's an alternate way to do it, right? They're the plaintiffs. It's their burden at this point, and they haven't met it. This isn't the final hearing. They don't have experts in criminology and, how to run a jail up there saying, no, you can do it this way. All they did was have, Chris Liu and the people from Highland saying that it has to be done this way for safety. That's the evidence before the court right now. I agree, it's terrible. I'm not saying it's good.
Why is the department allowing them to stay there?
Respectfully, they're at the Department of Corrections. It's the court that's allowing them to stay there. The court grants the ex parte petition.
I didn't order anybody to go to correction.
You didn't. The court system does not order anybody out of correction.
Should I? Is that what you're asking me to do?
No. I think you should make an individual. I think the individual judges should make individualized determinations in those cases.
What would the inquiry be?
How they're doing.
What do you mean, how they're doing? What does that mean?
I mean, it should be their condition. Right? And I think what the court should do in individual review hearings is look at how somebody is actually doing at the review hearing. Do they really need protective custody?
Well, I assume that these individuals are going to continue to meet criteria. And is that sufficient?
If there's a review that says they continue to meet criteria, yes, that is sufficient.
And there's no other, anybody who meets criteria can be held in corrections.
Not beyond the terms of this statute, which talks about while awaiting transport, if there is a...
Your contention, I have a second question about that.
Yeah.
I cut you off. Go ahead.
If there are beds open at API and beds open at a correctional facility, you would have to go to API.
Should I issue an order that says that anyone in corrections is at the top of the list?
I have no problem with that. That's what's happening now.
Do you contend that the people who are sitting in corrections are awaiting transportation?
I do. I do. That's the meaning of awaiting.
Even if there's no likelihood that there's going to be a place to be transported to?
That would only occur if API did, it's a question of how long they're going to be there.
Okay. What is there? Is there a limit? How long they can be there? I mean, what happens when the psychiatrists who have been hired decide not to show up or they don't want to work for whatever set of reasons? They're sick, they quit, and the capacity drops from the current, whatever it is, roughly mid-20s down to 10.
Right.
I just keep them in jail? And they can be await transportation for a month or 2 months? Is there any limit?
I think the limit would have to be cited at an individual review hearing.
And what would I tell those judges to be looking for?
I think you would be telling those judges to balance the condition of how they are, whether they appear to be gravely disabled or whether they appear likely to cause harm, right, against the possibility of when they could get in, and that could be a long time, against the possibility of future judicial review, right? Part of the standards, I think, with judicial reviews, there's that initial probable cause stage, right? And I think when all this was set up, the idea was that it would not take very long to get into a DET, right? And then there's a 30-day commitment, and that is a clear and convincing evidence burden. And so the idea is that your liberty is infringed for a short period of time, so it's a probable cause hearing, right? And then there's like a 30-day window, right, in which you're not going to get judicial review, and so you get a higher standard of evidence for that. And so I think the individual court would have to be balancing when can judicial review next take place, right? If it's going to take place the next day and we're going to check on how the guy's doing, that's one thing.
But as long as the person meets criteria, he can stay at corrections. And that's what you're basically saying. I have 5 reviews, and each time I say, yep, you still meet criteria, API is still closed, or still can't, the door is still closed because of whatever staffing issues there are. And you stay forever. That's an experience. You stay an indeterminate amount of time.
I think the question at that point is not how long you are staying at DOC. The question would be, are you having services at DOC?
Say that again.
I think the question would be whether you're having services at DOC.
What services are they getting?
Well, right now they're being seen daily by a psychiatrist and they have discharge planning. If they were to be staying long, I mean, if those services weren't being provided, which, by the way, they weren't in Lynch, there weren't any services being provided, and some of the county jails had actually been condemned, that would be a different story, right? But
okay, then what would the department's obligation be if I conclude that they weren't getting, however you want to define, adequate services?
The Department of Health and Social Services obligations to those people?
Correct.
I think at some point the plaintiffs are right that there has to be a plan, but I am not withdrawing from what I'm saying is that there's a difference between a preliminary and a final hearing, right? It may be that at a final hearing, after there's been a real exploration of everything, you may order a plan, right, to be done. But the requests today are real specific, and none of them are for a plan. So in general, can you order a plan? Yeah, I think at some point you would have.
You think that I'm legally prohibited from requiring the state to craft a plan now? And when by plan, I mean to deal with the people who, whatever the size of the population is, who's got an evaluation or are waiting evaluation of API, who was sitting in an ER in DOC.
Respectfully, Honor, today, yes. We have.
What is that prohibition?
Because we have an adversarial system of justice at which certain claims of relief have been asked for, and that has not been one of them. Okay. And
I don't think I have the authority to sua sponte suggest a preliminary or intermediate conduct by the state.
I mean,
I don't know what we're waiting for. That's, I guess, my point.
Right.
What are we waiting for?
I get that. I don't think we're waiting for anything. I think the evidence has been that the state is trying as hard as it can.
I'm not the one who needs to be creating solutions. I think I have an obligation to say to the state, here's the problem, here's your statutory obligation, here's even the constitutional overriding obligation, here's the crisis we all see, what's the plan for this these two subsets of populations. You folks figure it out, or at least try.
Right. What I'm saying is that what we've been doing at this stage is asking these specific questions. I am not saying the case should be dismissed. I expect that you will keep the case open. And I would expect, or what I think should happen at this stage, is that we should come back at some point and see how things are going, right? If the plan that Mr. Wall and Mr. Gentoli and Ms. Moreau told you about is happening, right? That's one thing. If it's not happening at all, that's another, right? And so I think what we need to do is get through this, these specific 9 requests.
Well, I think I should come back. Under your theory of, you know, the procedural posture of the win, when do I come back and reevaluate? What's the reasonable period?
I think the reasonable period is, I would go with the original contract date was discussed a lot. I would go after that.
Which was what, June 1 or July 1?
I think it was July 1. Okay, we talked about how WellPath would be working toward those goals. And so I think coming back shortly after, or I don't know, whenever we can do it, after July 1 would be a reasonable thing to do.
I thought the testimony from the gentleman from WellPath is that they're going to push it back to September 1, and included in that pushback is an extension of the obligation to get up to 80 beds.
I'll take September 1 if you'll give it to me, Your Honor. He also testified that he was working on September, on July 1 at this time, because that's how the contract read today.
But
if you'd like to do it both times, that's fine. You can have one every 3 months.
And in the meantime, there is no plan for what happens to the people who are awaiting. There's only a plan to increase the population either at AP, the staffing and capacity at API or at alternate facilities.
But increasing the population at API or alternate facilities means that the people waiting, that number goes down.
I appreciate that. But it also means that there are still people sitting there for whom nothing is happening. That's the people that I'm most concerned about. I appreciate that API had an existential crisis at the end of 2018 and was close to total collapse. And it's going to take a while to get that corrected. And it's unclear to me, I have my fingers crossed, but it's unclear to me that it's going to happen as quickly as we all hope. And I'm wanting to figure out what is going to happen to those people who are parked places in the meantime. It can't be that you just stay there until we increase capacity, because capacity is the only solution. At any rate, continue.
Yeah. Doe asked that the Title 47 respondents be immediately advised of the right to counsel. Again, that's not something DHS does unless it's the petitioner. I think, frankly, the testimony was that DOC tells people verbally but not on paper about their right to counsel, and I would think they would have to give them the paper unless there was some sort of safety reason not to.
Doe's third request was that respondents have to be able to call their attorneys. There was no evidence about a systemic interference with that. The two big ones here are that there have to be the idea that there would have to be evaluations at DOC or evaluations at an emergency room. That's the really big one. And as to having API personnel do that, I think it's been shown, frankly, beyond a reasonable doubt that that will lead to the destruction of API. And so there's no public interest in that. As to the idea that someone else should be made to do that, again, the problem gets back to the mandatory injunction problem, which is that Dr. Gurris' testimony, the only testimony about it, was that those sorts of evaluations aren't effective, that they don't work, that they're no good. And so that request should be denied because that request doesn't make sense and there's not a public interest in it. With regard to the part about the roster, there was no evidence that the state mistracks people. There was evidence that the Public Defender Agency has difficulty tracking its clients. Too bad.
Your argument all along has been you're doing exactly that. You're tracking. So all they're asking you to do is to give them a copy of the tracking report and give.
That's
and
why
give,
you've done that in your discovery order. It's moot. I mean, if there's no substantive reason for it,
hold off for another month, 3 months, 6 months, whatever it is, and do subsequent evaluations as to where we're going, why not simply continue that reporting?
The discovery order? I have no problem with you continuing the discovery order.
Okay.
Okay. So the Disability Law Center stuff, again, it's saying that DHSS can't house people in custody. Again, DHSS doesn't even see these orders until after they're issued. Right, so we don't. The DHS does not grant these petitions, and the evidence that you had, the evidence in this case from Ms. Wilson, was that either they can dismiss the petition with the 412, or they can ask the court to dismiss the petition. And so there's no evidence that DHSS can just release someone from DOC. Now the court may think it's appropriate to release someone from DOC, and may well order that, but I don't think the court can order DHSS to release somebody who's at another state agency. It just doesn't make sense. The problem with the immediate delivery to the designated evaluation facility is kind of the same problem that we talked about before with the evaluators going out, right? The evidence was that Fairbanks is full operating capacity, and so is Juneau, and we're working on North Star. Right, we have the DET beds. They've been unable to take people. We're working toward DES. So that gets back to the same idea that the alternative would be that DHSS has to release people. Again, DHSS can't do that because we don't have control over the court orders. Even if we came to the court and said, we think you should dismiss, the judge could say, well, I'm not going to, right? And so if they want to make that application to the court, great. Right, but that's not something DHSS can do. That again goes back, and then that follows up with the notice to the respondents.
What do you think your obligation is post an evaluation order?
To arrange and pay, strictly speaking, pay for transport. That's the statutory duty. There's a order issued in every case which wants a status report filed on where they are and why haven't they been transported. I think there is some sort of obligation, as Mr. Wall said, to provide a better system that we have today. But
why? Why do you have that obligation?
Hold on, let me phrase this right.
Take your time.
I think there's a couple reasons. There is a statute that sets out what DHSS is supposed to do. And while that is largely a prefatory statute an aspirational statute, right? And I think the goals mentioned in there have to be read in conjunction with any other requirement of any other statute. At some point, you're supposed to do those things. I think to the extent that, I think actually as Ms. Beecher said, there's a police power interest and there's a parents patriae interest in justifying civil commitment, and that there does have to be a reasonable relationship between the purpose of the commitment and, you know, why you're doing it. And so if you are confining someone under the parents patriae power, at some point there's going to be some sort of duty to do something, you know, to attempt to provide some sort of care and treatment. Now,
isn't that duty triggered as soon as the order is issued?
No, because they're not in DHSS custody at that time.
So you have no obligation to
waive an
order before they walk through the door?
Yes.
Can you close API?
There's a statute that says...
And fulfill your statutory obligation to that population?
Well, we can close API, but then we would have to ship everybody out of state.
Okay.
There's the statute, treatment shall always be available to state-operated hospital. So, and I don't think that the point about the... I don't know, it's not worth going into. So, again, the specific requests should be denied. Those are the requests they made. They're very experienced attorneys. They are not wrong that there's something bad happening, right? Everybody sees that. Nobody wants this. But the specific things that they asked for should be denied. To the extent that you want to come back at some time and hear more about what the state is doing, we have no objection to that, but the specific relief that they've requested is either ineffectual or impossible to grant. So I would ask that these preliminary motions be denied, and that, you know, the case will stay open and we'll have further hearings and we'll go from there.
What would those further hearings be?
Imagine they could be trials on the merits. I mean, there's claims that were not addressed in these preliminary injunctions. The DLC complaint is a whole thing about violation of EMTALA, and I believe the American with Disabilities Act. Perhaps they'd like to bring a claim about that. I mean, we'd have to do presumably some discovery and work that up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to make a few comments. So I just want to address a couple of things that are, you know, sort of strictly within the purview of DOC. Unless I misunderstood, I'm understanding the Public Defender Agency and the Disability Law Center to be saying that at this time they are not asking for anyone to be immediately released from DOC custody. I think that speaks to the fact that when there is somebody who's been found to need detention on a Title 47 mental health basis, that they need to be somewhere safe in protective custody, and that, you know, DOC as, you know, a place of last resort is, let's not say, I don't want to say this the wrong way, but that DOC holding those folks in those circumstances is not inappropriate. Now,
let's break it up into two situations.
Sure.
First situation is that you've got a person who's been charged with a crime, properly there under that charge, and then the criminal charges get dismissed. And that's the one category. And then there's the category that's an evaluation order in place, and someone brings that person to DOC doors and says, take this person.
I know there's been a lot of talk about the difference between those two classes of detainees, and while impressionistically it does seem like somebody who's already been in on criminal charges
or you know, whose sentence expired or who had charges that were dismissed, maybe because they were incompetent to stand trial, something like that. Certainly, the impression one has of those situations is that it's not as dire of a constitutional situation, but you know, in either case, you have somebody who's in on purely a civil order. And so I think legally, constitutionally, I don't know that I see a huge difference between those two classes.
Will DOC take anybody who not, anyone who is brought there under an evaluation order you will take?
I don't know about anybody, but they've been taking folks that were brought there by the police. Most of the people.
And what, when would you say no?
Well, I think DOC can say no.
Okay.
If that's your question,
I don't have any evidence. There's been no evidence of it having said no.
Right.
I don't know that that means that it hasn't, but
right.
There's no evidence of it having said no. All I know is that there have been, as I'm recalling, seven times when DOC said yes.
That's right. And you know, so I mean, based on the lack of evidence and, you know, frankly, lack of personal knowledge, I don't know that there are discrete circumstances where DOC would say, this, we will not take this person if they're brought here by, say, the Anchorage Police Department. But I will say, I mean, I think that ultimately DOC is doing...
Is there criteria when you will let the person depart?
Well, certainly, I mean, if DOC is the petitioner, which is often the case, if they're in on criminal charges, then DOC can withdraw the petition if they find that the person no longer needs detention. But if you're talking specifically about the group that's brought in, I think they would need to, I think legally that petition has to be withdrawn by the petitioner. I mean, DOC can do the examination and inform the court, and the court can lift that. The court can dismiss the petition, and which has happened, I believe, in Title 47 proceedings. But I mean, DOC generally, I mean, the vast majority of the folks that have come through that have been Title 47 detainees have been people who were in on criminal charges with DOC.
If the other department issues an order saying release, do you honor it?
You mean HESS? DHSS?
Correct.
If they issued an order saying release...
No, I mean, they do an evaluation.
If
they say release this person.
So if they did the evaluation that normally they would be doing at their own facility, that they've been asked by the petitioners to conduct at DOC or wherever the person is housed,
right.
DOC would not hold them beyond that. I can't see why. Of course, I mean... You know, we join with the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law submitted by HESS, and so, you know, we're not asking for that relief. But if the court granted that relief and said that, you know, these folks are going to be examined for their need for continued detention by HESS, and HESS says that they don't need detention anymore, DOC is not going to continue to hold them, I wouldn't think there'd even be a valid order at that point to continue to hold them. And it is, I mean, I agree with the court, you know, statutorily this is not what is called for. You know, what is called for is for the folks to be transported to API or another treatment facility as soon as possible. But, you know, it speaks to the fact that DOC is acting out of necessity here, that not even the petitioners are asking for them to be immediately released. They're asking for essentially a sped up plan to get this problem resolved. And I think that speaks a little bit to the motion for interim order that was filed by the Doe petitioners, because they asked for a lot of changed conditions within DOC facilities. And, you know, that's already been fully briefed. But, you know, I'll just point out that, as Mr. Bookman said, there's not been any evidence that any of the conditions of confinement that are being imposed at DOC are beyond what is necessary to maintain the security of both the detainees and the facility in general, and the prisoners there, and the employees. But, of course, it is a jail, and as Your Honor noted, you know, they're under, you know, pretty severe restrictions while they're there. There's no evidence that those...
Nobody's got any more severe restrictions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's evidence that nobody has more severe restrictions, but yes, they're under very... They are segregated from the rest of the population, but again, just as the petitioners are not asking for them to be released immediately from DOC facilities, you know, I don't take their proposed order on the interim order to really be asking that they not be segregated at all. They just don't want them segregated more than is necessary. Well, where is the evidence that they're being segregated more than is necessary? I mean, they're segregated from dangerous criminals. I think there's evidence that's been testified that that is necessary for their safety. I mean, they go to API, they're not surrounded by dangerous sentenced criminals. If they were at DOC doing all the same things they would do at API and communal meals and all the things that the petitioners are asking for in the interim order, that would not be the case. They would be around those people.
They're surrounded by people who have been charged with a crime.
Well, not just people who've been charged with the crime. I mean, there are sentenced criminals at ACC as well. And as a matter of fact, I believe they're on the west side of the facility. So, you know, that is the sentence side, generally speaking. But, and there are definitely sentenced criminals in MICMOD. I mean, I know that. And some of them are quite dangerous. And so that's all the testimony. There's not been any, you know, rebuttal testimony on that point. And, you know, the point I want to make is, everybody recognizes that's not where they should be. I mean, short of being out on the streets, it's not one of, you know, there's not many worse places you could be than in jail, right? But it's only because it's the least worst option, because the other option is to let somebody who can't take care of themselves or who is dangerous to themselves or others and put them out on the street. So if the question is what sort of immediate relief can be granted, and Your Honor, you know, mentioned in the meantime, while we're waiting for this API plan to work out, what do we do? I would just say that an order, you know, interfering with the functions of DOC facilities and, you know, ordering them to essentially create, you know, sort of a psych unit, or not a psych unit, but a, you know, psych hospital within a correctional facility is not an appropriate form of immediate relief. DOC, you know, ACC and Highland Mountain, they are correctional facilities and they will remain correctional facilities. And if there's any kind of, you know, we see the difficulty that we're having just in terms of, you know, the court can issue any order it wants, right? But the question is, how does it carry it out? I think that's the key question here today. And if the court is going to order that the state provide a hospital-like environment, the obvious place that environment should be created is at API. I mean, to order DOC to essentially convert part of its facility into a psych hospital so that it can be safe for these Title 47 detainees would be such a massive expense, and it's way less realistic than simply trying to speed up as much as possible this plan to get API's extra beds up and running, because we've got a bunch of empty psych hospital beds, you know, waiting for these folks that we just, you know, API just needs to get up and running. Why would we instead, while we're waiting for that to happen, to then go to ACC in Highland Mountain and say, you know, you need to provide API-like
environment. There are other alternatives besides building in DOC Title 47 ward. I don't think anybody really realistically is asking for that. The real question is, what is the state doing while API is getting up to speed?
Right. Well, Your Honor said that nobody's asking that they create that facility, but I kind of do take the interim order as asking for that sort of relief, because they talk about having, you know, meal times and activities and treatment all comparable to API. They even use that phrase. So that's all I'm really responding to. I mean, as far as what sort of interim relief the court grants, you know, that would relieve the necessity for these people to be at DOC at all, DOC has no objection. And certainly DOC, you know, we definitely see the necessity for, you know, for HESS to provide a plan to get API up and going and get those beds open, and for the court to continue to monitor the situation. I'm just speaking specifically to the relief that's been asked of DOC. DOC is doing everything it can for these people, but it can't become a psych hospital in the meantime. And if the court were to order these people out of DOC custody, that's not, you know, ultimately it's you know, these are people that should be going to the Department of Health and Social Services. So, you know, DOC is holding them essentially out of necessity, you could call it as a favor, you know, to not only HESS, but also to the state at large. You know, I mean, these are people that do not belong on the streets in their current condition. And it's a protection to the detainees themselves. And so that's the position of DOC on this request for interim relief.
Thank you.
Just a couple of points, Your Honor. First, I really think the state in part is misreading the Ninth Circuit law from King and from Jonas. The state seems to be arguing that there's a justification for the nature of the conditions that detainees are experiencing in corrections, but that's a correctional purpose. So we don't really disagree that corrections has reasons for what it's doing and reasons for how it's maintaining people, but that's not really the issue. The issue is whether the restraint of liberty broadly is justified. And so if you look at the King case and the Jonas case, the state's defense would have to be that there is a legitimate non-punitive interest justifying the detention at corrections. The state did not rebut that. The state did not provide non-punitive interests or explain how, in terms of it meeting the needs of the mentally ill, that it was appropriate to keep them and place them in corrections. Also, the restrictions cannot be excessive. So what we've got is a situation where, again, and I think the court is well aware of the evidence, there's isolation, restricted access to.
I think, did any of the people in this case had a competency exam or finding that was revealed to me?
I am reporting on our clients, Your Honor.
I don't have any evidence of that.
Well, we can present additional evidence on that point if we need to. The point is, though, and I think it is clear in the evidence, this is a cohort of individuals with significant mental health disorders. We've provided the court with a listing of how many instances there have been of people who have been held in corrections during the course of this case. There are approximately 209 days during which people have been held in corrections under these civil orders. The state could look at out-of-state placements for some of these individuals. That has not really been discussed, but again, given this crisis, that may be far preferable to keeping them in correctional settings here. So we would ask that the court find that these practices violate the statute and violate the Constitution and order the state to immediately come up with alternative plans to correctional placements.
Thank you. Anything further?
Just a few more comments, Your Honor. Forgive me if I jump around just a little bit.
Right.
I think the first thing I want to clarify is that what we're asking for is the immediate release of people in jail. If they can't be moved to appropriate facilities, that's what we've asked for. It's, of course, within the court's authority to make an order of any kind that they want. And the idea of having a plan, if that's a fallback that the court feels more comfortable with, I just want to make clear that that is what we've asked for, is for the immediate release. With the caveat that we think it's possible there are alternatives for where people can be held. Again,
but
the state
can... But the bottom line, though, is you want me to issue an order that says these people are to be released regardless of their circumstances, regardless of their condition, and they should simply be released.
If the state can show that it is impossible to hold some of the beds that they have open or contract for beds to be held open so that these people can be diverted instead of going to DOC, then yes, that's what we've asked for. I also wanted to point out that the county system in the Lynch case, yes, it's a different system. We're not saying that the same options are available here as were available in the Lynch case. What we're trying to point out is that the court's inquiry doesn't end with the state coming up with a justification. As Jones, King, and Lynch all say, the court's inquiry continues, looks at duration, conditions, and also whether there are alternatives to holding people in correctional facilities. I also just wanted to point out that I think there's been a possible mischaracterization of what Dr. Gerris's testimony was. To say that she said it was impossible and unethical to provide evaluations, that's not what I heard. I heard her lay out a system where she said it would be difficult and that there were things the state would have to put in place procedurally. I certainly didn't hear her say that it would be against public interest to provide people evaluations while they're waiting. I heard a lot of concern coming from her about the people who are waiting. And just as kind of a closing note, I think that, you know, the state's contention that people that are waiting in jail and correctional facilities when API is closed and not taking anyone are awaiting transport, that's undercut. I mean, the statute makes it pretty clear, but it's also undercut by what Mr. Seacott just said, which is that DOC can say no, but they're holding these people as kind of a favor. That's not the same thing as somebody waiting for transport. I just want to make it clear that the statute doesn't allow for the statute says only while awaiting transport. Holding people as a favor is not holding them awaiting transport.
Okay, thank you. Okay. All right, thank you. We'll be in recess.
Please, my very important thing is recess.